time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Was very exciting around here 45 years ago this week, wasn't it?
45 years ago, 1979 was the year, Bob. Chicago hosted our first papal visit ever. Pope John Paul II visited the city, and yeah, Bob, it was a huge deal all across the city. You know, up until that point, if you'd seen a pope, it was likely during a trip to Rome, not in the streets of your neighborhood. And Pope John Paul II, barely a year as pope, decided he wanted to visit American cities, not just cities. He wanted to get into the neighborhoods. And he did that in Chicago, for sure. He landed at O'Hare. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people were lining the streets. He went to the Northwest Side, the same kind of greeting. He went to Pilsen to greet Hispanic Catholics. Spoke to them in Spanish. His motorcade, you know, made its way through the city. People were hanging bedsheets out the windows. We love you, Pope John Paul II. Everywhere he went as he moved around. And he made his way to Chicago's Polish neighborhood. Pope John Paul was Polish and the first non-Italian pope in 500 years. At 58, he was also the youngest in over a century. And so he came to Chicago, you know, it was absolutely planned, not an afterthought, because Chicago at the time had the most active population of Catholics in the country and the largest concentration of Polish people outside Warsaw. So he made a stop here. And the thing is, though, as you listen to some of the coverage we pulled here, he connected with everyone. Didn't matter if you're Catholic or not. Everyone all across the city was warmly receiving this visitor from the Vatican, and he warmly received everyone he met. Here is some of the coverage from the time, Pope John Paul II's visit to Chicago.
The crowds here at the military side of O'Hare have ended their silence. They're waving, they're cheering, and they're calling out to him. You can't hear the Suzuki violins any longer. Some limousines have just pulled up, and what is becoming known as the Popemobile has just pulled up, too. It's a different one than we saw in New York, a black Cadillac that the Pope apparently is going to ride in. It's an open car. All of those limousines, the open car, and security cars are now pulling up in front of that line of dignitaries that you see.
I saw something on his face tonight that I have seen only a few other times. When he was extremely pleased, he feels warm, he feels comfortable at this second Polish town, he says, and he feels very glad to be here. I think we can all be very proud. It was a wonderful, wonderful welcome to Chicago.
Bill Curtis, and before that, Carol Marine. Mm-hmm. And then there was this huge gathering in Grant Park, wasn't there?
That's the thing that got the most coverage of all. He set a record for the largest public mass in U.S. history at that time, over 200,000 people in Grant Park. Even when he went to the Holy Martyr in the Polish neighborhood at 43rd, out on the far southwest side, 20,000 people were expected. 75,000 showed up just to that one church, and they later renamed part of the street in front of that church, Pope John Paul II Way. So,
yes, they did. Yesterday, we were talking about the 40th anniversary of that 1984 Cubs team. We have another Cubs history date to talk about today, don't we?
High hopes moment, another one for Cubs fans. 2008 was the year, this week exactly, 16 years ago, Bob. For the first time in half a century, the Cubs qualified for the postseason in back-to-back seasons, and they clinched the National League Central Division title September 20th, 2008. But recall, Bob, that at the time, they were one of the best teams in baseball. They had such an impressive season, finishing with the best record in the National League, the second best in the Major League behind the Angels. And think back to how we all felt as Cubs fans at that moment in time. This was it. This it is finally going to happen moment. You know, it was that we really felt this 8 years before it finally really happened. And when hope was alive that this was the year that they'd go all the way, we pulled one of the memorable moments from the game this week, 2008.
Terry Wood is on the mound trying to save it here in the ninth. The Cubs so close. A high fly ball. And for the first time in a century, back-to-back postseasons for the Cubs.
Yeah, well, the fun didn't last long, did it?
That wasn't the year they went all the way, Bob. Yeah, like we know that. The Cubs were swept in the first round by the Dodgers, losing Series 3-0. So just one of the more memorable letdowns in the Cubs' history of letdowns. But 8 years later, they came back and won it all. That was not to be the year.
No, it wasn't. And there was a major business born out of a fun card game here in the suburbs this week in 2010. I don't know about this. Talk about it.
Have you played Cards Against Humanity?
No.
Bob, you never played this? It's a little deck. It's a black-colored deck of cards. You're probably too clean to play it because it is kind of raunchy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the reason. Uh-huh.
But it sold tens of millions. I mean, like, literally, this is huge. Back in 2010, a major business was born out of just some suburban friends in Highland Park. It got together, and they kind of liked Mad Libs, and they kind of liked apples to apples, and they decided they'd come up with this game where a card is drawn, and it asks a question or makes a provocative statement, and then everybody lays down their card to try to compete to be, you know, the most clever, the wittiest, sometimes the most wildly inappropriate. That's how it works. And it's just one of those games that it took off. It was huge. They started it with a Kickstarter in the fall of 2010. They wanted to raise $4,000. They actually raised $15,000, and a business was born. In 2011, released to the public, Cards Against Humanity became the number one game sold on Amazon 1 month after it launched, and has since sold tens of millions of decks. So, quite a success story.
How did I miss that? I guess
the less raunchy.
Well, not yeah.
You and Marianne can play. It's a kid version.
I'm a spin the bottle guy. That's me.
Drops keep falling on my head. Thank you. That doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red.
Yeah, it's Nick the Lounge Singer, and I didn't realize actually it all started here in Chicago, didn't it, Anna?
It was a big deal, Bob. You know, he's so funny. I love Nick the Lounge Singer, but he was a character that started at Second City and became the character, Bob, pretty critical to Bill Murray's later success. The Lounge Singer character actually based on the real-life lounge act Jimmy Damon, who some listeners may remember. When Bill Murray got his big break, true story, to head to Saturday Night Live after Dan Aykroyd left, big shoes to fill, right? Bill Murray was not an instant success. In fact, there was even some talk that he might not last that long. He kind of flubbed some lines. He sort of struggled in the starring roles. Writers stopped writing main roles for him. He later said, I was kind of relegated to second cop status on SNL. So it wasn't going well. But then he debuted the old Lounge Singer act on Saturday Night Live. Nick the Lounge Singer, the guy who never let his dingy surroundings let him down, whose confidence often outweighed his talent. But it was awesome. You know, here's a bit we pulled. Bill Murray on stage as Nick the Lounge Singer with fellow castmates and Second City alums Gilda Radner and John Belushi.
Welcome to the Potter Room, everybody, up here at beautiful Meatloaf Mountain. I'm Nick Winters, and I'm here to entertain you, so sit back, have a hot buttered rum, and let it happen. Now, what do I see here down in front? We got a cute little girl here with a cast on her leg. Honey, why did you bother to come up to Meatloaf with a broken leg?
Oh, well, I'm Marilyn Sundberg, and I rented my skis and boots here at Meatloaf Mountain, and my bindings were too tight, and I broke my leg walking over to the tow lift.
Oh, bummer-ski, huh, everybody? That is awful. I am going to autograph your cast here, if you don't mind. Don't eat yellow snow, Nick Winters, all right, honey? Hey, who's this crazy dude? Your old man?
Paul Sundberg. I'm from Minneapolis.
Mr. and Mrs. Sundberg, this next song is going to be for you, because I hope that leg heals and you're back on the slopes in a couple of weeks. Oh, that cast makes me so sad. Oh, don't it make my brown eyes. Don't it make my brown eyes. Don't it make my brown eyes. Blue.
I'll tell you, you can't beat Meatloaf Mountain for entertainment, can you?
No, you cannot. Well, you can. You can't beat Gilda Radner and John Belushi in a skit with Bill Murray. How classic is that? So cool.
50 years of Saturday Night Live, and this season is the big anniversary for them. Let's talk about Ebert and Siskel and the first time they were on The Tonight Show.
This is pretty cool. 1986 was the year. Let's go back to that year, Bob. Gene Siskel, Roger Ebert, already pretty big stars in their own right. They had starred on sneak previews on TTW, moved to At the Movies, their syndicated review show, and they were now invited to appear for the first time on the Johnny Carson show, and the dueling movie critics did not disappoint. Siskel and Ebert always seemed to be themselves on TV, which is one of the reasons they were so well-loved. They didn't put on an act. They were themselves, and they took the stage after Chevy Chase, who was still there, as they got into it with each other. They got into it with Johnny. They got into it with Chevy Chase. Here they are, Siskel and Ebert, on the Johnny Carson Show.
Roger is film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Gene is with the Chicago Tribune. Would you welcome Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert?
Have you gentlemen met Mr. Chase before? Have you seen most of Chevy's pictures?
I saw most of it, yes.
What was his best picture, in your opinion?
You think Fletch is better than Vacation like I do, right?
Anything you say, I'm certainly not.
I'll tell this to you.
I'll tell you what you do. Let Chevy do what he used to do in Saturday Night Live during the news thing. You go ahead and talk and let Chevy do what he used to do.
That'll be fine. Okay, fine. There is a tendency for somebody who is naturally funny standing there and ad-libbing when somebody else is trying to talk.
That's right.
I hope you were kind to me because, after all, we haven't brought up O Heavenly Dog yet.
Oh, God.
And I'm sure Gene and Roger fought over who would sit where next to Johnny, who would talk first.
Who was right, who was wrong, yep, about what movies. And mm-hmm. then we kind of got into a Johnny at some point because Johnny was wrong on something. I mean, it was just, it was just hilarious. And they endeared themselves to this whole new audience, Bob, because people already loved them, but now they were on the Johnny Carson Show, and their banter was for everyone to see, and just genuine and loved, you know, that kind of thing.
Miss those guys. That was from October of 1986. And finally, candy history going way back. Here, tell us this story.
Go back in the time machine to the fall of 1868 in Chicago, Bob. Way back, a Chicago candy maker named Charles Gunther opened a confectionery at 125 South Clark Street. And it was there, legend has it, that he invented the caramel.
Hmm.
So thank you, Charles Gunther. I love caramels. And before that, though, you'd get the chocolates, you'd get the hard candies at all the the chocolatiers and candy stores. And Chicago was the candy capital of the world at that point, or the country, not the world, at that point in time, right around the turn of the century. But he introduced the caramel. And what isn't so clear in the history books is who was the first to put it on popcorn. They most credit the Ruckheim brothers, German immigrants, who were pouring the caramel on popcorn, mixing it with nuts, and then making the first Cracker Jack. But Gunther helped popularize that snack, too. He also invented the chocolate cigar, and he made another contribution to Chicago society. And this was interesting. I had no idea about this. Because he amassed quite a fortune in the candy business over time. The Palmers would go, all the wealthy families were like, he was the go-to for their chocolate and their candies and that kind of thing. And he became the largest collector of Lincoln memorabilia in the country. He owned Lincoln's deathbed, Lincoln's piano, his carriage. A towel used to soak up Lincoln's blood. He had John Wilkes Booth's memorabilia. He had a shoe from his horse and some other things, thousands of items, historical items. And in his will, he gifted all of this to the city of Chicago with the caveat the city had to build a large, fireproof, impressive building to house all of these items. And they ended up building it near North and Clark Street right there, and it became the Chicago History Museum. So how about that? Not bad for a guy who started peddling caramels on Clark Street.
Yeah, and he also introduced dental cavities to the Chicago area.
How true is that? They're the worst, aren't they, the caramels?
Anna DeVlantis, more this week in Chicago History next Wednesday. Thanks, Anna.
Talk to you then.